Hey there, Sexology listeners. This episode is brought to you by Quince, your go-to for affordable luxury. I have to tell you about my latest find, the champagne silk dress from Quince. It's perfect for date nights, especially in the summer. It looks so expensive and feels like a dream, but you won't believe how affordable it is. Quince is all about high-quality fashion and home goods at a price that won't break the bank. How do they do it? The unique manufacturer-to-consumer model cuts out the middleman, bringing you premium products straight from the factory floor. With Quince, you're not only saving money, but also making a sustainable choice. Plus, they offer free shipping and a 365-day return policy, so you can shop with confidence. Check out their amazing selection at quince.com and grab free shipping plus 365 days at quince.com/sexology. Upgrade your wardrobe without the guilt. Thanks to Quince.
Welcome to Sexology, a podcast that untangles the science of sex and pleasure. And now, with this week's episode, your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Moali.
Hello there. Welcome to episode 390 of Sexology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Moali, and I've got something super insightful for today. Today, we're going to talk about the tough topic of infidelity. Cheating can really rock a relationship, breaking trust, messing with intimacy, and stirring up a whole bunch of feelings. Today, we're busting some cheating myths, delving into the messy world of infidelity, and giving some advice on how to deal with it. Our special guest is Dr. Kirk Honda, a seasoned therapist, professor, and host of Psychology in Seattle podcast and YouTube channel. Dr. Honda's got tons of experience helping couples heal from infidelity and rebuild their relationships. We'll be tackling some big questions in this episode. Can cheating ever be justified? Are there situations where straying is a reasonable response to relationship issues? Looking at the Ashley Madison documentary, do you think external factors like websites or social circles play a role in someone choosing to cheat? Is cheating a two-way street? How do you handle shared responsibility when it comes to infidelity? And a very highly debated question. Are humans naturally monogamous, or is monogamy an unrealistic expectation that leads to cheating? Should society be more open to non-monogamous relationships? This episode is going to be a deep and thought-provoking chat about a topic that touches many of us. Whether you're dealing with infidelity fallout or aiming to fortify your relationship against its risk, you'll find some valuable insights here. Before we dive into the episode, just wanted to give a shout out to our wonderful sponsor, FirmTech. As a psychologist and sex therapist, I'm always exploring cool ways to boost sexual wellness. Let me share something mind-blowing. FirmTech's Tech Ring. Worried about bedroom performance? Curious about what works best for you with meds, supplement, exercises, and diets? The Tech Ring isn't your average cock ring. It's the world's first smart one that goes on and off easily with their patented hook and loop closure. Picture this. Track it to hack it, then adjust your dosage. With the Tech Ring, guys can access their erectile fitness score to keep sexual wellness in check and address erectile issues. It's not just for sex. Wear it overnight to monitor nighttime erections for insight into heart and sexual health. The Tech Ring monitors firmness, length of time, and more in the heat of the moment, revealing how factors like relationships, meds, subs, and alcohol impact your performance. Tested it with my partner, and it's a game changer. Easy to use, more pleasure, and intense orgasms. For top performance, the FirmTech Max PR, their non-tech ring, enhances pleasure and endurance. Let's be honest, rings trump pills for most guys, according to FirmTech. Safe, comfortable, and easy to use, smooth texture that glides on effortlessly and closes easily with their loop and hook. If you ask me about a cock ring, chances are I've recommended FirmTech. Try it for insight into sexual health and performance and pleasure, and you'll love it. They offered a discount code for our sexology listeners. So head over to the link below, type sexology, and it's going to give you 10% off of their product. All right, no more waiting. Let's dive into this chat with Dr. Kerr Khanda on the Sexology Podcast. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Sexology Podcast. I am so excited to welcome Dr. Kerr Khanda. Kerr, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
I am very excited about this conversation. Infidelity, betrayal, it's one of those things that whenever we do a show about those topics, often we get tons of follow-up questions. I think the last time we did that was a few years ago, I think with Tammy Nelson, and now it's like we're due to do another one. So I see a lot of people post affair coming into my practice, and I hear all the stories that people tell themselves about what results to cheating, what the cheating is about. So can you tell us some of the pervasive myths about cheating that you see in your practice?
Yeah. So there's many, but just to name a few, one of the myths that I hear is that it takes two to cheat. And yeah, depends on what we mean by this. But when we are cheated on, there can be sometimes a message given to us, particularly by the person that cheated on us, but maybe even by people around us, maybe even by therapists, that we, as the victim of the infidelity, somehow caused it. And might there be factors, you know, if my wife were to cheat on me, might it be useful for me to look into what I was doing that was making the relationship not as strong as it could have been with her? But to be clear, I would not be to blame if she were to cheat, in the same way that if my wife were to, you know, abuse me or something, might there be a factor involved from my side? Yeah, but I would not be to blame for the abuse. Just like if a child is bullied at school, might it be useful to look at the victim's personality or their behavior or their pattern so that they can prevent this happening in the future? But to be clear, they're not to blame for the bully. So that's one myth that needs to be dispelled. And part of this, I think, is based on the patriarchy, and that a lot of infidelity historically, traditionally, was by men. And the system and our society would blame women. You know, you're not having sex with him enough, or you're not appealing enough, or you're too nagging. You are demanding when all she's asking for is minor accommodations in the relationship. And this notion of, you know, you're dwelling in the past. So, you know, takes two to cheat is something to dismantle. Another myth is once a cheater, always a cheater. I don't really hear this in my practice. I hear this more online. And yeah, if someone has cheated in the past, there is a slight increase in the risk of cheating in the future. But lots of people have cheated in the past. You know, the statistics are all over the board because we're asking people to self-disclose. And also, like, where do we draw the line, you know, between actual cheating and infidelity and like just toying around with it? You know, is flirting cheating? That, you know, it's like, where do we draw the line? But generally speaking, anyone who has cheated in the past, even if it was extensive, can change. And, you know, the circumstances might be different. Obviously, there's a lot of therapy that can be worked on. So once a cheater, always a cheater is not found in the data. Another myth that I hear a lot, particularly online, is that, you know, women cheat for emotional reasons and men cheat for sexual reasons. And this implies that there's this fundamental difference in terms of our attachment and our relationship needs and wants between the genders, and the data doesn't show that. Our society will influence people in a way as they're developing, you know, girls will be socialized in a different way than boys in general. But when we actually look at the data, and particularly when you look at more nuanced research, it's clear that there's a wide variety of people and You might have a woman who's more concerned about sexual infidelity, and you might have a man who's more concerned about emotional infidelity. So, you know, it's a person by person difference.
You brought up so many great myths that I want to definitely talk more about it, but it seems like you had more to add. So please.
Yeah, just a couple more. I mean, one is that cheating means divorce or breaking up. Like you have to break. You'd be stupid if you didn't break up with someone that cheated on you. And again, case by case basis, in my practice, I have worked with many couples as they recover from infidelity. And if they work hard and I do a good job, then these couples are stronger, much stronger after the recovery. It's hard. It's a process. The cheater has to go through a lot of changes and transformations. It's usually fundamental to their personality that led them to cheating. Not that they're psychopathic necessarily, but you know, the avoidance or the pain or the traumas that they went through, the kind of defenses they have. It's not easy, but cheating, infidelity is an opportunity. Now, if a victim of cheating doesn't want to work on the relationship and would like to break up, then absolutely, but it doesn't automatically mean that. And it doesn't mean that you're weak if you decided to stay and work on things. Also, just another myth that I will hear sometimes, again, mostly online, is that, you know, hey, my partner isn't having sex with me, so what else? You know, a man has his needs. He's got to get out there. You know, it's a mandate of biology that I must have sex. And obviously that's silly. Now, if there's a problem with regarding to differences in libido or in being, you know, sexually fulfilled, then obviously, you know, work on that, talk about it, figure something out. But the answer isn't, well, I'm just going to cheat.
Well, I love all the points that you brought up. And I've seen, like, similar to what you were describing in my practice, lots of nuances of all of these situations. I think infidelity, couples who choose to work on it, it requires tons of effort and sitting with discomfort and uncomfortable emotions. But I agree with you that it highlights the challenges we have individually and relationally when we are going through this process. So it's a great opportunity for you to learn about yourself, the resources, whether it's if you were someone that a quote-unquote offender or the someone that was cheated on. To the first point that you said it takes two to cheat, and we talked about that. And I could say yes or no. I want to hear your thoughts. So one thing is that sometimes cheating happens. It has nothing to do with other partner. You can be an angel, perfect partner. The person going through something, maybe you were a wonderful partner and that triggered their avoidance style of attachment, right? So it could be a number of different reasons. And yeah, they go out of the relationship and it has nothing to do with you. You can think about how you can navigate it. That's completely understandable. And sometimes there are challenges in the relationship that contributes to the affair. Affair is never a solution, right? And it's never justified. But I can see that also that happens at time. So how do you suggest people look at those situations, right? The situation they can see the part that they had in it. For example, many people are thinking sex is optional. And it could be kind of a non-essential if you're asexual in your relationship. But saying that I'll address it. And then they realize that their partner was going out of the relationship and having sex. Again, affair never, they're not justifiable. There's so many different ways that you can manage it. But then we're going through this process and we're going to reflect on our part. How do you recommend people to kind of look at these situations and what does make sense from your perspective as far as like guiding people through this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the $1 million question. Every situation is different. So I can only provide a framework that is not very specific, but the framework is that you go through infidelity together as a couple and you should recover from infidelity as together as a couple if you plan on actually staying a couple. But, you know, even if you plan on breaking up, if the two individuals wanted to recover from the infidelity regardless, I think that would be fantastic for both people and for their future partners. because if the cheater can work through that, then they're less likely to cheat in the future. And they're also just, cheating is a symptom often of deep suffering. That's what I have found. Before I was a therapist, before I started working with couples, and even before I started working with couples regarding infidelity recovery, I had the cultural notion that cheaters cheat because they just want their cake and eat it too. They might have trouble with self-control, or they don't have integrity. And those things could be at play. But every single time I have seen someone commit infidelity, it's because the individual has had long-term suffering and pain, and they don't have solution to their traumas. And these behaviors are part of that struggle. So if they were to work on that struggle, then as a symptom, they will be less likely to cheat. But more importantly, they're not suffering on a daily basis anymore. But and then, of course, even if the couple breaks up for the victim, they can benefit greatly by going through that with the cheater, in that the victim will feel less likely to be overly distrustful and paranoid and hypervigilant in the future. But anyway, so if the couple's going to stay together, then they have to recover together. And that involves going to couple therapy with a specialist in infidelity recovery. And in all likelihood, both going to individual therapy, particularly the cheater. That isn't, I think, always necessary, but it often is. And it certainly can't hurt. So that's one part of the framework. The other is that as they go through that process in therapy, it's imperative that the cheater fully reckon with what they did and stop avoiding the facts, which is almost always what they do. They will minimize, they will deny, they'll justify, because how could they do it in the first place if they didn't have a robust ability of denial and minimization and justification, often modeled by their own parents, by the way? So it's really hard for that cheater to admit that, even to themselves, let alone to their spouse, let alone to the therapist in the room. So that's a huge journey. And I work with cheaters on this, and I always get frustrated, but the more I do it, the less frustrated I become. It's very frustrating working with people who commit infidelity, because 9 months in, after we've been over the facts and they've said in therapy many, many times, yeah, that's the whole truth. There's no other infidelity. I'm not lying anymore. Some new detail will come sneaking through, and the victim will tell me, look what I found on her phone, da 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 da. And I'll be like, oh, so let's start over. So if we're going to rebuild this relationship, you've got to come clean, but I know that the personality doesn't change overnight, and the fear is there, that they're often withholding that information because they're terrified of losing their partner, ironically. And it takes time. It takes years, but it has its frustrations, but that's my responsibility. I have to deal with. And for the victim, it depends on their approach, but some victims will often have their own personality issues, and they might hold on to some extent because they just want to hold that over their partner's head. There's a fine line between what I would consider to be reasonable and understandable vindictiveness or pain and anger from the victim, even a couple years later, even 10 years later, really. But figuring that out as a therapist from my side is important, and having those conversations. I'm very hesitant to label victim anger in that way because it's totally normal, but there is kind of a line, obviously. So as they go through that infidelity, the other major and final part of the framework that I'll say is that most, if not all, of your personality problems will come to the fore through that process. So for both people, you know, things that you thought you had, you know, changed, things that you didn't know about yourself, things that you would rather avoid. They can't be avoided. They have to be faced. Things like your childhood traumas, your approach to anger, your approach to love, your approach to sex, your sexual trauma, you know, everything just comes. There's only so much time, but all those things in all likelihood have to be addressed. It's not a simple thing of like five sessions to really recover from infidelity, because if, you know, if the victim is going to trust their partner, they have to have a reason to trust their partner.
Also, what I've discovered is that similar to what you were talking about, how it can be very meaningful, complicated, multifaceted work. What I've noticed is that healing and recovery really comes in different waves. One wave is that when people kind of go to actual couples therapists, they feel like they talked about it, they accepted accountability, but really kind of like sometimes people figure out, oh, shoot, I have not processed it. When they resume having sex, when they want to show vulnerability, and I hear clients say, like, I just can't have sex with them, or the rawness of the emotion comes up, or some of my clients, they have a legit trauma response, like a PTSD response, that like when we were doing this, I was just like flooded with the idea of, did he or she do that with this other person? So some people, the sex life, sex is not important for them at all. And then like if the work on the relationship part, kind of having a strong sexual connection doesn't necessarily is as of much of a priority. So it's not a change in the relationship. And not every single couple that they go through infidelity, their sex life is getting impacted. I have clients that they say our sex life is the only thing that remained unchanged. You actually brought up some rawness, this emotion of our partner being with someone else, helped me to see them in a different lens, seeing that how other people, another person desire them, brought that newness into our dynamic. But one of the common narrative that we hear, and I know I shared with you, I recently watched Ashley Madison's documentary on Netflix. And the kind of story we heard as they were telling the Ashley Madison website's kind of marketing strategy, that people that thought like, okay, Ashley Madison is this evil, or people talk about this attractive woman at work, she's seducing people. So at times I hear people think about more about external entities. So kind of think about, this is the responsibility of those people, those organizations. That's why this happened to us. I know it's very controversial. I'm curious about your thoughts.
Yeah, well, on one level, when you look at broad populations, then you can blame organizations like this or cultural elements that will increase the rate of infidelity. You know, I'm sure they didn't do this study, but if you took 10,000 people and, you know, with 5,000 of them, you started marketing Ashley Madison, you know, banner ads and other kinds of marketing methods, would you find an increase in infidelity among the group of people that were marketed to? You would probably see an increase. Even if it wasn't with Ashley Madison, it might just kind of plant a seed, if you will. So in those ways, you can say that these kinds of organizations are, quote unquote, to blame. But on the individual level, I would never think that an individual, their, you know, the thousands of choices, that's the thing about infidelity that I came to learn, is that to cheat 99.9% of the time is to engage in thousands of decisions to cheat. It isn't just a spur of the moment thing, which is often the way that the perpetrator will frame it. And it might be a lot of decisions building up to infidelity that you didn't think of as being headed in that direction, but you did know it was headed away from your partner. Things like, you know, spending an extra few hours at work, or not working on the relationship, or not opening up to your partner, not telling your partner that you're not happy with your sexual life. Or spending a little bit more time after a few glasses of wine DMing your ex-girlfriend. Yeah, it's just a friend, you know. And maybe you don't cheat with your ex-girlfriend, but it's these little movements that if you really stopped and there's nothing wrong with talking with your ex-girlfriend, but you know, all the time when I investigate the buildup, the precursors to cheating with people, and they have enough self-awareness to lay it out, you see perhaps years of this movement in that direction. So to say that Ashley Madison is the only reason why someone would cheat is ridiculous, because all Ashley Madison was on that individual's path was but one of thousands of little influences, you know, because you can't take someone in a secure relationship, and you could do all the marketing you wanted to regarding Ashley Madison, and that individual would never click that button, would never cheat. So that's what I'll say. It's both a factor in all likelihood, but I would not say that Ashley Madison was to blame. Plus, like, when we live in a capitalistic society, you're going to find profit in infidelity, and that's what we have. So, you know, it's the same when it comes to pornography or sex work. Can we blame pornography or sex work for infidelity or for that kind of behavior? No, but if you don't have it, you're less likely to have people engaging in it, obviously. But, you know, everyone is on a path of thousands of influences and decisions and whys in the road. So, yeah, if we did away with Ashley Madison, I don't think that infidelity would stop.
And you mentioned something very interesting that I often think about, like, if there's no sex work, right? If like we're banning the sex work or porn industry, how would that impact infidelity if there are not organizations like Ashley Madison? My audience, they know I grew up in Iran, and Iran, it's a very now, like not before, I mean, last 40 years, a very religious country and very patriarchal, and after woman life freedom, what they did to fear women, saying that they had this billboard in like a city square having two women, one with a kind of a hijab, like all from black hijab, no makeup, covering her hair from top to bottom, and there was this another woman with hijab but not covered as much, and they put it on the billboard. Which one do you want your husband to be the co-worker with? I was like, what does that mean, right? Like, if my husband cheats on me or my partner cheats on me, 100% is on them. My hope is, like, I don't feel they are in the cage, that they cannot see anyone. And as soon as they see someone mildly attractive, they go with the person. To me, this logic is crazy. And also with the sex work, right? In Iran, sex work used to be legal and now it's illegal. But we know that throughout history, sex work has existed. So what happens when something is illegal? Now there are minor trafficking and all sorts of cruelty against sex workers. So to me, as you were talking about, I feel that there are aspects of human psyche that exist, right? So I think, like, there was some truth to what the banner was for Ashley Madison. Life is too short, have an affair, right? So like we said, life too short, enjoy it. So that's what we all heard. But again, it comes into accepting that we have this vulnerability. And where am I in this world with vulnerability? If I cheat, I always tell my partner, it's on me, right? Like, it's on me. I made the decision. And I realized people are different. Some people feel like, okay, I'll make this small decision, that wouldn't make a difference. And some people they don't have the awareness, as you were talking about. Like, I'm completely okay. I can DM everyone I want and I'll be okay. And they just kind of make themselves more vulnerable. But for the couples that you work with, what are some of the key risk factors that can increase the likelihood of cheating? Again, the reason we're saying this, not saying that the partner necessarily caused the cheating, but we're thinking about how can we possibly address the vulnerabilities in our relationship?
Yeah, that's a good way of asking the question, that it's more about how can we all strengthen our relationship, strengthen our own personality such that we don't do things that compromise things. You know, if deep down you're not really into the relationship and you'd rather be with someone else, or if deep down you're polyamorously oriented and you can't manage monogamy, then, you know, it's not just a matter of figuring out how do I become dedicated to my partner. It's about, do I really know myself? And have I constructed a life around my needs? So that in terms of the working on the factors, it's not just, you know, trying to be more dedicated or something. It's really global to your personality and to your relationship. The factors that we found in the research and in my own experience are the more attachment insecure you are, the more likely you are to cheat. It's not a strong signal. You know, it's not like securely attached individuals don't cheat. And it's not like every, you know, very preoccupied or very avoidant, very disorganizedly attached individual is going to cheat, but it is correlated in that when we grow up with a lot of attachment injuries and harm and neglect, lack of attunement, we will develop defenses against that pain and against that rejection. And those defenses will shoot us in the foot, in our own foot, as we try to navigate the ups and downs of a relationship. For example, if our dad abandoned us and that was very painful to us. So the way that we coped with that is to be hypervigilant about relationships, to be overly concerned with the state of mind of our loved ones so that we can game the system to get more attunement and avoid abandonment again. And then we get married and we're very hypervigilant and very noticing of our partners and overly paranoid that our partner is going to abandon us when there's no sign of that. We're in a bad mood. We might accuse them of things. We might start to be controlling. That's going to push people away. And through that relationship difficulty, I'm going to be more likely to cheat because I just don't feel secure in the relationship and I have a lot of ups and downs. Plus the relationship quality will go down, which is also associated with infidelity. That's another major factor, is just a lack of connection. You know, when people don't feel connected, you know, that's what I always think. It's like, for me, it's a, because, you know, working with couples, I'm often working with everyone, regardless, I don't know about you, but I often reference myself and my own relationship, you know, because we can read all we want, but living life is its best academic source. And so for me, I think about, well, why don't I even have the impulse to cheat on my wife? You know, what is that? I don't consider myself to be of more honor or integrity than anybody else. So what is that? And when I think about even the slippery slope to that, even if she never found out, and honestly, my wife is so nice. She would probably forgive me if I did those things. So I don't even necessarily see like a very negative outcome. I mean, that's funny to say out loud, but point is that I just don't want to, you know, even if I had an impulse, you know, I'm human, there's impulses, but you know, there's a connection there that I carry with me into, you know, the deepest part of me that deep, you know, because that's where infidelity begins, is deep inside. And so that even deepest part of me is like, what are you doing? You're hurting us. You're hurting, you know, your life. You're hurting yourself just to entertain that idea. So when you lack a connection, you're going to have more infidelity. And along these lines, more conflict is going to be associated with more infidelity. Substance use is a big one. Alcohol use is a big one. Often infidelity begins, or the thought begins, the process begins when drinking. You know, our inhibitions are down. We might regress to an earlier part of our maturity. There's a lot of associations there. And then substance use can also lead to conflict. Another factor is a cultural belief or a personal belief that cheating is normal, can absolutely be a factor. You know, men are men, you know, that's what they're going to do. Or, you know, there are some societies where it's just understood that, like, I don't know if this is real, but the TV show Sopranos, I love that show. All the dudes have gumars, or I don't know what they call, you know, they have women on the side, and they all consider it to be just completely normal. So that's an extreme version of that. And I'm guessing some sort of a racist caricature of those kinds of people. But anyway, also declining sexual satisfaction. can be a factor in declining relationship, you know, satisfaction. Again, not something that we would say is to blame, but it can be a factor. You know, makes sense. Also, a personality trait of impulsivity, whether that's related to ADHD or mild psychopathy or full psychopathy, or just impulsivity, you know, impatient people or people that have a hard time with their superego kicking in under certain circumstances, they're going to be more likely to cheat. Not necessarily with the cheating part, because that's quite a leap in terms, you know, it's not like if I were impulsive without any buildup, I would just boom, like, oh my God, I'm having sex with someone else. Like that's not how that works. But the impulsivity to DM somebody or the impulsivity to, you know, reach out or to flirt or something, you know, it's just a factor that can be involved. Also, and it's pretty obvious, but low relationship commitment, right? A lot of couples will say, well, I don't know, we were basically divorced, or, you know, we were going through a rough patch. And so it wasn't much of a leap to start cheating on that person. So those are all the main factors. Some of those are research oriented, and some of them are the way I'm wording it are just like my own experience.
Well, there are so many things, as you mentioned, that could contribute to someone going out of their relationship. Definitely substance use and alcohol use is a common theme that I hear, especially like it's what's interesting in cisgender women. I have like the people at times other myth people think that only people who cheat are men because men are men. But in my practice, I have a significant number of women that they cheat on their partner and they work on themselves or at a couple session to kind of address the issue. And majority of time they say, like, I started drinking, I drank too much. Again, alcohol, I don't think is the issue, right? Like we are suppressing our part of ourselves to give ourselves permission to be able to do this. The same with other substances, or even at time I tell people porn, right? Sometimes people kind of fixated on our issue is porn, but the issue could be golf. It could be something else, right? Like in our partners hyper fixated on doing something else that doesn't include us, it could be something there. And I think with infidelity, that could be also a part of it as well. And I know how, like, I'm sure you experience it a lot in your practice, that it can be really, really hard for the people who experience betrayal to forgive the partner. First of all, it's not something that you have to. Society definitely judges, especially women, that they forgive their partner. They make the decision. They think, oh, they were weak. We all heard about Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and how people perceive Hillary after that, right? They feel like we don't respect people's decision. So tell us about the forgiveness. How is it possible? How can people move toward that direction?
Yeah, great question. So I like to define things before talking about them, especially with a word like forgiveness, because there's so many different working definitions that people operate from. I did a whole deep dive on apologies, and that led me down a whole rabbit hole regarding forgiveness and all the cultural notions around forgiveness and the, you know, American Christian versions of forgiveness. And so let me provide my definition that I came to in my deep dive, which is forgiveness is an intentional process. So it's a process you go through on purpose with a plan. You're going on a campaign that eventually results at a decision to end your negative attitudes and feelings towards the transgressor. So forgiveness is, it's a process that you go through. So if someone, you know, if my wife were to cheat on me and I, and, you know, the two of us went through a pattern or a process of recovery, and I chose, it's a choice. Forgiveness is a choice, but it's also not a choice that you make and you instantly will forgive. It's a choice to go down a road, especially with a big transgression like that. You know, if someone bumps into me at the shopping mall, I can choose to forgive that person right away, even if they don't apologize. That's another part of forgiveness, is you can make it dependent on an adequate apology, or you could just make a decision in your head. There's a lot of different paths to it. But if I were to go down that process, then I would say, okay, I'm beginning the intentional process to forgive you. And I can't, and so on one hand, this is just me in this hypothetical, I don't want these negative feelings towards my wife. At the same time, I have these negative feelings towards my wife, whether I want them or not. And there's another part of me that kind of feels like I deserve to have these feelings of hurt and upsettedness and distrust. So what does that mean? Also, what does it mean to understand, you know, like if I had a friend who frequently was late to things, like really late, maybe like to pick me up to go to the airport or something, and it really impacted me negatively. They might apologize and I might actually forgive them, you know, because they're my friend. And I, in my head, even without them apologizing, I might just in my head just say, you know what, I'm not going to have ill will. I had ill will that one day because they didn't pick me up, take me to the airport. But, you know, what are you going to do? They didn't do it on purpose. It wasn't personal. They do it to everybody. But I would say, I'm never going to ask them to take me to the airport again. You know, I'm not going to hate them. I'm not going to look bad. I'm not going to get disjoint, you know, sort of upset around them. But I'm not going to trust them with taking me to the airport. And whenever they tell me that they're going to be at a certain time and place, I'm not going to believe them until I see it. And so I've forgiven in that instance, but I haven't forgotten. And I am, quote unquote, holding on as I move forward. So with infidelity, you know, there's a lot of different ways of looking at it. You can go down an intentional process of healing the relationship such that you no longer, as the victim, have negative feelings and thoughts towards your partner. You know, you've crested that hill where you don't wake up in the morning and look at them with disdain and disgust, you know, which is normal. And you've crested that hill again through a process that you've gone through. And that could take years, take a long time. And you now no longer wake up in the morning or look at them across the table and think, I can't stand what he did or what she did to me. And you can't do that overnight. You can't snap your fingers. That's something you got to do. And it's something you choose to do. It's an intentional process. Okay. And yet, say you're 12 months into the recovery, you still wonder when they're on their phone texting and you don't know who they're texting with, if they are texting with somebody that they're cheating with, or that they are in the process of beginning cheating or something. And in your head, you're thinking, I don't know if I can trust my partner. So is that forgiveness? I would say that is forgiveness in the way I described it, but you're not irrationally forgetting the past. You know, the best predictor of the future is the past. The sun will rise tomorrow because it rose today. My wife will not cheat on me tomorrow because she didn't cheat on me yesterday. So if someone cheats on you, then, you know, there's a much greater chance that they're going to cheat on you or do something else that will harm you, you know, in terms of distance at the very least in the future. So forgiveness is, you know, it's complicated. And I'll be working with a couple who had infidelity 20 years prior, and they are still together, and they, you know, the victim has forgiven, but they haven't forgotten, and their body hasn't forgotten, because every once in a while something will trigger the victim and they'll get angry and hurt and it'll come back around. But if a couple recovers well enough, each time the cycle comes back around, the couple will get through it easier and easier. And there's a whole process. And typically what happens, just as a side note on this, is that the perpetrator will say, this again, what are we doing? And so what I say to the cheaters, I'll say, if you're choosing to stay in this relationship, you're choosing to cyclically revisit this infidelity for the rest of your relationship with this person. So that's what you're signing up for. If you do everything perfectly, 25 years from now, your partner will turn to you and say, I can't believe what you did that night. And you have to, you know, muster the differentiation and the maturity and the compassion and the self-awareness to face it in the moment and say, I'm sorry that I did that 25 years ago. And you go through the whole, you know, and each time you do that, then it gets easier every time. So forgiveness is complicated, which is different from the way that it's often talked about, which is that you just decide. And again, in the patriarchal system often aimed at women, that they're dwelling on the past and they should move on. And there's also this, I was raised Christian, so I could say this, that there's a Christian notion of that to forgive is to be godlike, to be Jesus-like. And, you know, because according to the story, Jesus didn't go through a forgiveness process and there wasn't a lot of apologizing to Jesus for original sin and whatnot. And so you're just supposed to let it go. And geez, wouldn't that be nice if we could just let it go? Like our mom abuses us for the first 15 years of our life. And if we could just let it go and no longer have any ill will or bad feelings or, you know, residue, wouldn't, you know, it's a fantasy. So, and that notion often benefits systems of power, which often is committing massive transgressions on the powerless. So it's very convenient that the power structure encourages this notion of instant forgiveness.
Absolutely. The other thing that at times I hear people kind of like react to is that I just want my partner to guarantee that they won't cheat. And they want it kind of like a reason kind of for future why that's not going to happen. I understand that it's really important to be committed, right? Because no one want to go to the relationship and get re-traumatized. But also if you are looking for guarantee, right? There's no guarantee. And like that's a path that you can just kind of go around and around looking for a guarantee. And I tell people at times that my relationship with my partner, with my husband, we are very committed together. But I personally don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, right? Because just like infidelities are just so multifaceted. And we kind of like do our best today to build that relationship. But I feel like that's also another hook that people get hooked and they kind of like say, oh, but I just need the guarantee. What do you think about that?
Yeah, great question. So on one hand, for individuals who are raised in a certain way with abandonment and betrayal and inconsistent attunement, that can create a defense, as I was saying earlier, of hypervigilance and preoccupation and anxiety regarding relationships, which can result in this obsession with, is my partner cheating on me? And I need to make sure that I keep an eye on that and monitor that. You know, it's this constant nagging feeling. You know, why do I not have that constant nagging feeling? Well, people on the outside would say, well, your relationship must be good. But, you know, for anxiously attached people, they can be in a wonderful relationship without ever having been cheated on by their current partner for 15 years and yet still have this intrusive thought of, you know, she's cheating on you. He hasn't texted you back, or he's at work. Do you know he's at work? You know, what do you really know what's happening? She was looking at that guy at the mall. Does that mean that she wants to have sex with that? You know, it's weird. It's irrational. Usually preoccupied folks know it's irrational, but it's still in their mind. So on one hand, the irrational, intrusive thoughts of hypervigilance and anxious attachment are, you know, for the most part, separate from any sort of in-world reality that needs to be recovered from and healed from and dealt with. It's not something that an individual should deal with in isolation. They should work on it as a couple, because the fastest road to security is to build a secure relationship that's a corrective experience, but also just to go to your partner and say, like, so when you did that thing, I had a paranoia that you were cheating on me, and that's on me, that's not on you. But can you just reassure me that you're not cheating on me? Because I have this paranoia. You could really help me out. That goes a long way. It's hard to do, because when you're convinced that your partner's cheating on you, it's hard to say it with such differentiation. But me and my wife say similar things to each other when we're at our best. So, you know, it's normal. The other side is that if a couple has gone through infidelity recovery or has gone through infidelity, this notion that often is discussed is trust, you know? And yeah, wouldn't it be nice if the victim could trust, right? It would change the way the relationship feels. It would, in all likelihood, strengthen the relationship. It would make it feel better for both people. But it's ridiculous. Why would you trust someone that, like I said earlier, chose thousands of times to break that trust. It's such a big deal, right? It's not like withholding information about like your favorite color. You know, if I for some reason had this weird thing about me that said I'm not going to tell my wife if, you know, what my actual favorite color is. Like, there's not a lot of consequence that my wife would say if she found out I was lying or withholding. She'd be like, that's weird. Why would you? But to withhold this information in most relationships and to lie about it is such a, even if it was just one night, it's such a massive trust violation. And for the victim, it's rational and totally understandable for them to say, well, what else have you lied to me about? Is everything a lie? Do you love me? Do you say you do, but you were acting for the past, you know, number of months that you weren't cheating on me. So how can I trust anything? And then, you know, for the victim also, tragically, they start wondering if they can trust anybody. You know, that's what this does to you, because someone is right there in front of you, kissing you and hugging you and saying they love you and wearing the wedding ring or whatever. And meanwhile, they're living this double life. It's just a complete mind screw. And if the infidelity is extensive, then I mean, it would be irrational to suddenly start trusting your partner after that. Even if the partner has done a lot in therapy, you know, or has turned a new leaf, it makes sense. So what do we do with that? Well, it takes time, you know, and to not trust, you know, like if with my couples that are going through this, and I talk a lot about this process and they tell me what they're going through, but for the victim to not trust their partner, you know, there's different things that we can trust. So say we're 6 months into infidelity recovery, you know, weekly sessions, and both people are working hard. Well, the victim at that point can trust that their partner will continue working on the relationship and continue going to couple therapy and will continue to have vulnerable moments of discovery and bonding and all that kind of stuff. But if the victim wants to or is distrustful of their partner regarding infidelity, then that's a different kind of distrust. And so, you know, trust is something that takes a long time to build and an instant to dismantle. So for these couples, it's like that at work, like at a warehouse where they say, we've had 300 days since our last injury on the job. Well, it only takes one tiny injury to reset that clock to zero. And then you're starting over. It doesn't take into account. You could have 1,000 or 10,000 days, but you have an injury on the job and it resets that counter to zero. You could have 10 years of seeming in non-infidelity, and then you could have an infidelity episode and it resets that counter to zero again. And you have to rebuild that trust. And it's harder to rebuild trust after that point because you've violated the trust. You know, when you first met, you hadn't yet violated the trust yet. But once you violate the trust, and this is the known phenomenon when we actually research cheaters, one of the most universal thing they will say is, I had no idea the negative impact that the infidelity would have. I had no idea. I thought it would blow over, or my partner would forgive me quickly, or they would never find out. If I could go back, if I had a time machine, I would go back and just, you know, shake myself and say, don't cheat. Everything, you know, it's not worth it. A few moments of physical pleasure is not worth the lifetime of struggle and pain and bother that you will have to go through. Trust takes time.
Well, for our listeners at home, Dr. Kirk Honda and I, we talked about like an outline we want to talk about, and we're at point number two. So I know that I can talk to him for hours, but the good news is you have a lot of great content online that our listeners can go and check it out. You have your YouTube, you have your own show. So tell our listeners, if they are intrigued by our conversation today, what are some of the places that they can find you?
Well, just a podcast and YouTube channel called Psychology in Seattle.
Awesome. So we'll leave a link to those resources in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing all of these pearl of wisdoms with us. And hopefully we will have you back in the future.
Sure. And we got to point two because I'm a yammerer and you're a very good listener. I can tell that your clients appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. I loved all the things that you covered. As we wrap up this episode, I wanted to chat about some eye-opening stats on infidelity. So get this, studies say around 20% of married couples go through infidelity at some point. Surprisingly, a good 50 to 60% of these couples stick together and work things out. Feeling lost or overwhelmed dealing with infidelity in your relationship? Don't hesitate to reach out to a therapist for much-needed support and guidance. Check out the link in the show notes if you're ready to book a session today. Oh, and before we jet off, big thanks to our sponsor, FirmTech. They've got this top-notch cock ring designed by a legit physician. And hey, for our Sexology podcast listeners, you get a sweet 10% off using the code Sexology at checkout. Thanks for tuning in today. If you dig this episode, drop us a review and share with anyone who could use the chat. Until next time, stay safe and keep exploring those relationship depths.
Thanks for listening to the Sexology Podcast. For more great content, visit www.sexologypodcast.com. Please be advised that information presented on this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health provider.